Well, hello. My name is Angel Wood, and this is Crime of the Truest Kind. Well, how have you been? Welcome back. Follow the show. Do all those wonderful things. Crime of the Truest Kind on Facebook and Instagram. At Truest Kind on Twitter. The official Crime of the Truest Kind merchandise store open for business. I'm very excited about this. I ordered all kinds of test pieces and they look pretty good. Pretty good. Thanks to everybody who's been hanging tough. I am late on this episode. So let's just say I had to dig deep into some archives and reached out to people who covered the case, those people who I could find. So thanks very much to the people who helped with information gathering. Thank you, J.M. Lawrence. Thank you, Emily Sweeney. Thank you, Julie Manganis. This is a 25-year-old case, so information isn't plastered all over the internet like more modern stories are. It took much greater research on my part. I had to reach out to people. I had to fill in some of the much needed information to do the story justice 25 years later. So on today's episode, I take you to Peabody, Massachusetts, in the story of Kristen Crowley. Peabody, Massachusetts. The estimated population in 2019 was just over 53,000 people. It is located in the North Shore region of the state, 23 miles from Boston. People from Peabody include Brad Delp, singer of the band Boston, which really is the best choice when you think about it. Peabody, Swampscott, Gloucester, none of those work. Boston? Yeah, feels right. Although Waltham is a band, and they are awesome. Brad Delp was born in Peabody, raised in nearby Danvers. And fun fact, my mother worked with him at a company in Danvers called Hot Watt. And a secondary fun fact, I grew up thinking that Danvers was Danvis until I was probably about 12 years old. It's an accent thing. Brad is known as the nicest guy in rock and roll, and he died tragically in 2007 by suicide. Now, that story is awful, and I'm not going to get into it here, but maybe another time. Also from Peabody, Massachusetts, Garcelle Bouvet. Beautiful actress, author, podcast host. You've seen her in movies to include Spider-Man, Coming to America, Barbershop. She did TV. Miami Vice was her very first role. She's also one of the Real Housewives, and she is currently co-host on the daytime talk show, The Real. Gary Gulman is from Peabody. He's a comedian. A super sweet guy who used to come on my morning show on WFNX back in the day, and I recall inadvertently groaning at some of his jokes. It was early. And I'm very sorry, Gary, if you're listening. You are really very funny. Gary went on to do Last Comic Standing and made a great documentary called The Great Depression for HBO in 2019. There's another Gary. Gary Cherone lives in Peabody. Now, Gary is the lead singer of the band Extreme. He was in Van Halen. In November 1996, he joined Van Halen, replacing Sammy Hagar, who had replaced Dave Lee Roth. Van Halen 3 was released in March 1998, made a respectable showing. We were proud, kind of, with a debut at number 4 on the Billboard charts, selling 197,000 copies in its first week. Now, the record didn't sell in the typical Van Halen fashion, but the tour did seem to be met with enthusiasm by fans. A number of earlier Van Halen songs returned to the live set, stuff Sammy Hagar wouldn't do at all. Gary left the band in 1999, worked on a number of other musical projects, including the Boston Rock Opera, and he rejoined Extreme. Peabody has the North Shore Mall, the largest in the region, with 163 shops. It became home to the Apple Store on September 1st, 2001. Now, that is a proud distinction, as it was the first Apple Store in all of the Northeast, and only the 6th Apple Store to ever open in the world. Yay, Peabody. Now, in 2017, Apple moved the store to Market Street Linfield, a new bougie open-air shopping village. It is quite nice. I've gone there a number of times. Peabody is home to the Golden Banana, what they call Boston's North Shore area's premier adult entertainment mega club. It's a strip club. It's been there for as long as I can remember, and it does make an appearance in this story. The city of Peabody is responsible for one of the earliest fire laws. On October 28, 1915, a fire broke out in the basement of St. John's Catholic School on Chestnut Street downtown. Teachers rushed to evacuate the 600 students inside. The fire drill procedure could have led the children and teachers through the stairway and out the rear exit. But as the fire burned faster, thick, noxious smoke filled the air, spreading so rapidly through the three-story brick and wood building, it was engulfed in less than 5 minutes. There were no fire escapes and no fire doors. Many escaped through windows, and some kids were even forced to jump from upper levels. Others ran to the front, and similarly to the station fire, they jammed the front vestibule entry. When the fire was finally put out, the bodies of 21 students were found inside the school entrance, burned or crushed to death in the chaos of escape. The cause of the fire is believed to have been arson, and as a result of this fire, Peabody became the first city to pass a law that said all entrances or exits in public buildings must be push open rather than by a handle or a knob. In the years that followed, Peabody became an industrial hub, known as Leather City, as it was the center of New England's leather industry. The city welcomed people from all over the world to work in the tanneries. I watched the documentary about tanneries. It's called Leather Soul. There are more than 100 in the city, supporting a community and raising families for much of the first half of the century. The smell of the chemicals used by the tanneries permeated the air in Peabody, bolstering its working-class reputation. But tanneries were very important to the area.
You know, you get up in the morning to go to work. Every factory had a foghorn. Kirstein's and whatever, Holly Street and maybe 30, 40 factories.
And it was like Mozart to my ears. Mozart and his family. All the factories blowing their whistles. Everybody wanted to work in a leather factory because they paid more than a city worker, a policeman, and a fireman.
But as the industry changed and automation became more prevalent, working leather in sweltering and dangerous conditions became less and less sought after. But for a time, everyone worked in the factories.
See, and I think this is what next generation said, look, the heck with this kind of work. I don't think any of the girls now would go and swab skins the way we did, never. And I think a lot of that, I think perhaps was that we knew how hard we worked and we didn't want our children to do it. So we worked so that we could educate them so that they wouldn't have to do the work that we were doing, okay? You think I'd want to see my daughter go in and work the way I did in the leather factory? Never.
I gotta tell you, I love those accents. It's exactly what my house sounded like when I was growing up. My Nana grew up in next door Salem. So these gruff and crusty people, they are my people. While all of that is part of the charm of the North Shore city and its history, little is known about a woman named Kristen Crowley who spent most of her life in Peabody. Born Kristen Suzanne Gove on June 12, 1969 in Lynn, Massachusetts. She was just Chrissy to her close friends and family. She was beautiful, stunning, statuesque, friendly, and loving. She commanded attention everywhere she went. That was the unfortunate price she paid. Just after midnight on June 2, 1996, she stopped at a local convenience store to grab a couple of things before she headed home. Two men, who had just left the Golden Banana strip club near the store, saw her, stalked her, and attacked her. Now, this happened in 1996. This June marks 25 years. The world is a completely different place than it was when Kristen was alive, and her loved ones chose to remember the way she lived. Her husband spoke of how she could make a room full of sad people happy. John Crowley didn't get enough time with his new wife. The two were married in October 1994, not even for 2 years. They'd first met in high school, dated for about 3 years before their wedding at a Danvers hotel, and John Crowley was devastated to lose the love of his life. Someone, by all accounts, had a goofy sense of humor. Her brother Kurt, who played in a number of bands, including one with a friend of mine, but was active mostly in New York City bands like L.E.S. Stitches, Lower East Side Stitches. He was equally as destroyed with the loss of his little sister. Whenever they got together, they were always laughing. He was the punk rock guy, but she was the life of the party. Her friend spoke of how, while she was a beautiful girl, she exuded a genuine warmth and care for those around her. A friend from their freshman year in high school called her headstrong and hilarious and incredibly caring, and talked about how her relationships were so important to her. A neighbor of Kristen spoke about memories of her as a little girl who loved to camp in the woods and who insisted that she be Jill Monroe, Farrah Fawcett's character, when the neighborhood kids played Charlie's Angels. I remember wanting to be Jacqueline Smith. Kristen loved shopping with friends, skiing, driving the motorboat at her dad's lake house in Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire. Dancing and live music were her favorite things. And on that last night, that's what she did. She met a friend at a restaurant in nearby Saugus, and they headed to a bar in Peabody inside the Holiday Inn to see a band. Her mom, Susan, who separated from Kristen's father when she was small, was a huge part of her life. The two were in constant touch and spoke several times a day. They were incredibly close. She hired Kristen to work in her computer training company, located in Reading, about 10 miles from the Peabody condo Kristen and John rented from her mom. Chrissy used to brag about the fact that I was her best friend, her mother, her landlady, and her boss, Susan Gove said in one interview. Kristen had been diagnosed years earlier with a stomach disorder, and chronic abdominal cramps made it difficult for her to hold a steady job. Co-workers at the company they both worked for also spoke of how close they were. This was an incredible loss for her family. The community began fundraising to support programs and legislation designed to help victims of violent crime. It was a way to channel healing energy. Action in place of feeling helpless is something in times of such profound grief. Kristen didn't live to see her 28th birthday. She was killed 10 days short of the celebration. The depravity of her death was shocking, and as details were revealed, it became increasingly more grisly. Small-town crime is one thing, robbery, car chases, disputes between neighbors. But stalking, abduction, and murder is something else entirely. It set off a wave of fear, anger, and grief. Women were afraid of being followed. How many times have you seen someone driving a little too close for a little bit too long behind you, and you take the long way home hoping you lose them? I have always avoided pulling into my driveway when that happens. Oh, and yes, it does happen. But we don't know what Kristen knew. We don't know if she realized she was a target. And the clerk at the store that night was concerned enough about the behavior of the two men that he walked Kristen out to her car. Did he say anything more? On the night of June 1st, 1996, two men, a 25-year-old new father from South Boston named John Keegan, and his 23-year-old ex-roommate and former Marine buddy, Timothy Dykens of Cambridge, who'd met while stationed at Camp Lejeune, told their girlfriends they were going to a tool expo, but they ended up at the Banana, the Golden Banana Strip Club on Route 1 in Peabody, where they spent hours that night drinking and propositioning dancers. At least one former employee of the club testified to this. I'll get back to that. Around 12 a.m., unsuccessful in convincing the dancer to go with them, Keegan and Dykens left the club and ended up at a nearby Mobile Mart convenience store. That's where a tall, vibrant woman walked in. Kristen Crowley was on her way home after catching a band with friends. She met up with them sometime after working one of her occasional private parties. She did make extra money doing this sometimes. Gone were the days of women working in the sweltering tanneries. The tone of the reporting of her story by some is what bothered me. The subtext was that she somehow was responsible for her own murder. Headlines read, "Stripper murdered, dancer killed." It was simply dehumanizing and salacious, just to move papers. It was 1996. People read the newspaper. Some even got it delivered to their doors. Can you believe that? I'm sorry, newspaper people. It's not a joke you want to hear. Kristen Crowley did do occasional private party gigs. It's something not everyone knew about her. Her mother didn't know. For a lot of people, it's not something you tell your mom. Her husband, John, did know, and there's no information that I could find that indicated she was a stripper in a club at all. She was not working at the Golden Banana, as some people may have misconstrued in the telling of this story all those years ago. Kristen dropped by that store on the way home. It was something she'd done dozens of times before. She grabbed a few things, bottles of water, Mountain Dew, a can of Chef Boyardee. Late night snacks, we've all done it. These items were among those found strewn about the parking lot of her condo, where her husband John was, inside their apartment, building her a new waterbed and looking forward to a relaxing Sunday. Keegan and Dykens' interactions were captured on the store's video camera that night. There was no denying that they saw her. The clerk on duty saw Keegan leer at Kristen and say, "He wanted a piece of that." It does beg the question, had they done that before? They gawked, they ogled. None of it was harmless. We know what their intentions were, because Dykens gave the comeback, "You know what we've got to do." They objectified her. Who she was unimportant to them. Kristen did not know them, and they clearly did not know her. What a good person she was. How she wanted to go home, see her husband, and see her dog Madison. Keegan commented that Kristen resembled one of the dancers they had been watching at the club just minutes before. The clerk, an obviously young and dumb kid, mentioned to the two men that she was a stripper. I see that as an obvious attempt at a dude-guy bonding moment. The judge in the case ended up issuing a protective order, guarding the identity of that Mobile Mart clerk who was working that night. People had gone back to the store to confront him about what happened to Kristen. And that clerk was concerned enough that night by the way the men behaved that he walked her to her car. It is not known if she was made aware that these two drunken, horned up 20-something guys in their big night out were talking about her like this. They had a plan. When they failed to convince one of the dancers to leave with them, they happened upon Kristen. Or she happened upon them. They had propositioned a dancer moments before they encountered Kristen at the store. Cheryl Ann Parrott, a dancer at the Golden Banana at the time, told police that the men offered her money for a date after seeing her dance for hours in the club that night. The former dancer testified that Dykens asked her to have drinks with him and Keegan at the end of her double shift. She changed and joined them at the bar, where Dykens asked her if she would go on a date with Keegan, telling her his wife had died about a year before. Parrott said she believed the story, but refused to leave the club with the men. Keegan's girlfriend was at home with their newborn baby. The story was fresh bullshit. And remember, they both told their girlfriends they were going to a tool expo that Saturday night. More fresh bullshit. During her testimony, Parrott said, "He seemed to get a little annoyed that I wouldn't go, and that Dykens kept offering more money to go out with Keegan. I remember telling him he could go up to $1 million, but I still wasn't going to go." There was definitely festering hostility with these men. Because within 1 hour's time of leaving that strip club, they stalked, kidnapped, attempted to rape, and brutally murdered a woman. As Kristen pulled onto Lowell Street, Dykens and Keegan trailed behind her Ford Explorer the short distance from the gas station to her home, about a half a mile. These two men, ex-Marines, and I say that for two reasons. One, being in the armed forces has always had an air of respectability. And two, most Marines I have known were physically fit. I don't know if this was the case for these two, but I will presume they were strong, they were juiced up, and they were aggressively horned out. As she got out of her car and walked toward her condo, Kristen was ambushed, forced into the woods, her clothes were torn off, and she was beaten. Dykens tried to rape her. As sick as it sounds, he couldn't do it. Not because he had a shred of humanity. In my conversations with reporters who covered the crime, the talk was that Dykens was unable to physically perform. In the crudest and simplest terms, he couldn't get it up. That must have enraged him. Pure savagery. And she fought. They found a large rock nearby in those woods and killed her with it. That was work. Dykens' defense passed it off that he could not have possibly done this on his own, as Keegan suggested, because he was too intoxicated. And I will come back to that finger pointing. He may have had a flaccid penis, but he brutalized her. Perhaps it was a coke dick. Now, there's no evidence of cocaine use in this story. But also, I don't spare the feelings of killers. And rape isn't about sex. It's about power and control. And how dare any woman tell them no. We know Kristen fought. She fought for her life. There was a can of Chef Boyardee and two bottles of water on the walk, one of them told police. And in the parking lot, they discovered a pair of women's underwear, just a few hundred yards away from where her husband was waiting for her to come home and see her new waterbed. Some neighbors walked out to the edge of the parking lot and called out. They heard some voices, but they couldn't quite make out what was happening. One went to get a flashlight and called the police. A 911 call came in shortly after 12:30 a.m. with reports of a woman in distress. Police reported to the complex, and then the search dogs came. At 12:45 a.m. on June 2nd, about 15 feet from the parking lot, there was Kristen. Badly beaten, in only her bra, in the woods of her condo complex. She had died within 1 hour of those two men seeing her and leering at her. They were two monsters. Blunt force trauma. They used a large rock to crush her skull. Court documents say it was 47 pounds. It was a profane level of brutality no one could fathom. I didn't know Kristen, but the thought of what she experienced horrifies me. A neighbor saw a man later identified as Keegan approach the door of her condo and carry off a woman's pair of shoes. Why? Was he pretending to belong there? Witnesses reported seeing two men, one in dark clothing and one in a white shirt. Keegan drove off in the rented car they had had for their big night out and left Dykens behind. He bailed on his pal. Dykens was left to hoof it along the railroad tracks that ran from behind the complex into Danvers, where that department was alerted of the attack and found Dykens walking along Route 114 at about 3 a.m. He was soaking wet and holding his bloody t-shirt in his hand as he wandered. When he was picked up by police, the alibi he had was absurd. He was left scratched and bloody because he got in a fight with a friend at a bar. And Dykens was wet not because he had been trying to conceal evidence of a murder, but because he had fallen in a puddle. A canine unit tracked Dykens' scent from the roadside where he was walking to the spot where Kristen's body was found. That's a, what do you call it? Oh, a smoking fucking gun. Detectives concluded their questioning and charged Dykens with the murder of Kristen Crowley. Keegan was missing. He went home, or somewhere, to buy some time to figure out what kind of bullshit he'd make up to disassociate himself from the brutal stalking and murder. What did they learn about Dykens and Keegan? We know that Dykens and Keegan met while serving in the Marine Corps. They were roommates until about a year before the murder. Timothy Dykens grew up in the town of Winchington, an hour and a half drive west of Boston. He was 23 years old and was working installing carpets. Dykens served 4 years in the Marines, but was convicted of larceny in a military court and served 4 months in a military prison for stealing government property. At the time of the murder, he was planning to enroll in a local community college to study criminal justice. Of course he was. Dykens and Keegan served together at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. Keegan left the Marines in January 1993 after 3 years service on less than honorable terms with an administrative discharge. Sidebar, if I may. Service in the Marine Corps ends with retirement or discharge. The regulations set out various types of military discharge, including three varieties of administrative discharge. Other than honorable, general under honorable, and honorable. Of the three different characterizations for administrative discharge, other than honorable discharge is the most serious. An OGH means you lose the ordinary benefits and rights of military veterans, including eligibility for the GI Bill, for Veterans Administration benefits, as well as pension benefits from the Marine Corps. John P. Keegan grew up in Quincy, went to school there, and graduated from North Quincy High School. He too was looking to get into criminal justice. Of course he was. At 25 years old, John Keegan was living in a second floor apartment on East 8th Street in South Boston with his girlfriend and their month-old daughter. He was supporting them by doing carpentry work and delivering flowers on the side for extra money. A year before the murder, Keegan had applied to join the Quincy Police Department. When he showed up to take his police exam, instead of acing it, he was booked on an outstanding warrant. His background check was laughable. He was denied a position with the department as his background check showed several arrests, including alcohol, disorderly conduct, and assault. Quincy Police Chief Francis X. Mullen, what a great name, Francis Xavier Mullen. What else would the X be for? He spoke about Keegan's background at the time of his arrest for murder, saying Keegan's application was rejected after a routine background check turned up what the chief termed behavioral problems. At the time of his arrest, Keegan had an active restraining order against him issued by the South Boston District Court. He'd been charged with several assaults. More than a year before he was charged in the brutal killing of Kristen Crowley, Keegan broke into his former girlfriend's I Street apartment in Southie and beat both her and the man that was with her. Keegan was sentenced to a year of probation for the assaults. One resident told of hearing the woman's screams. Another neighbor on the street said the break-in and attack came after Keegan had been seen lurking around the woman's building after she broke it off with him. That neighbor told Boston Globe reporter Zachary Dowdy he was stalking her. She had broken up with him and was seeing another guy. And the three of them were here, and there was a scuffle, and the police came. Shortly after that, she moved away. That woman obtained a restraining order against Keegan after the May 26, 1995 attack. He was on probation, and the order was still active on June 2, 1996, when Keegan and his former roomie, Dykens, stalked and killed Kristen Crowley. That order was one of at least three restraining orders obtained against Keegan. A South Boston District Court judge ordered Keegan to undergo counseling for alcohol abuse and complete a domestic violence program for batterers as part of his sentence. Don't know how that went. I'm guessing it went not good. Dykens was arrested in the early morning hours of June 2nd after being picked up shirtless and soaked along the side of Route 114 in Danvers. He was on foot since Keenan had left him at the scene, so he followed the railroad tracks out of Peabody and was picked up as he tried to make a phone call. Keegan was arrested that Sunday afternoon after his lawyer was notified that a warrant was issued for his arrest. He turned himself in to authorities. A grand jury indicted the two men on first-degree murder charges on Wednesday, June 12, 1996. That would be Kristen Crowley's 28th birthday. When they arrived for their arraignment on June 25th at Essex County Superior Court, they were under heavy security, shackled and bulletproof vests, as they pleaded not guilty on charges of murder, attempted rape, and kidnapping of Kristen Crowley. They were met with a united front, with more than a dozen of Kristen's family and friends sat in court and wore black and red ribbons to signify grief and solidarity against violence. There was a lot of raw emotion. Friends and loved ones wanted vengeance, and they needed to be restrained from attacking them in the courtroom. Dykens and Keegan were held without bail after the hearing. They had been moved shortly after their arrest from Essex County Jail in Middleton to the jail at the East Cambridge Courthouse for their protection. It was an intense case, and the story was being covered on local and national news outlets and in newspapers. There was a great deal of finger-pointing. Keegan claimed he never touched Kristen, with Dykin saying it was impossible for him to commit the crime alone because he was too intoxicated. And Keegan took off, leaving Dykins behind. Dykins had no other choice but to try to walk and find some way home. He was bloody, soaking wet, the look of a guilty man. The first trial got underway in October 1997. The two men would be tried separately, with Keegan's trial immediately following Dykens'. Jurors were brought to the Mobile Mart, where a video camera recorded an exchange of glances and words that authorities say preceded the murder that night. Jurors viewed the crime scene in the grounds of the complex where Kristen's clothes were torn off and she was dragged into the woods, assaulted, beaten, and bludgeoned to death. They saw the site on Route 114 where police found a soaked and shirtless Dykens carrying his own bloodstained t-shirt. They knew that a canine had tracked his scent from the roadside to where they found her body. The court heard testimony from witnesses, friends, the clerk, the dancer from the Golden Banana, and experts in the field. On October 27, 1997, after 4 days of testimony, Timothy Dykens was convicted of first-degree murder and would serve life in prison. A jury of 5 women and 7 men deliberated for 2.5 hours. Dykens sat straight in his chair as the verdict was read, legs in irons, his hands were bound in shackles. His only response was shaking his head in silent disagreement. Timothy Dykens is alive and well, and living the dream at the Old Colony Medium Security Correctional Center in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. That's to the dismay of some of Kristen's family members, who wanted the death penalty. John Keegan's trial was set to begin as soon as Dykens ended. His defense team saw the writing on the wall. So on the day his trial was set to begin, Keegan pleaded guilty to second-degree murder. As a result of that plea, he was sentenced to 15 years to life in the kidnapping, attempted rape, and murder of Kristen. He became eligible for parole after serving 15 years and received credit for the time he spent in custody awaiting trial. Keegan was sent to MCI Norfolk, a medium security prison in Norfolk, Massachusetts. Fast forward 14 years to October 2011. 14 years after he admitted to his role in Kristen's murder, John Keegan went before the Massachusetts Parole Board to be let out of prison. His co-defendant, Dykens, unsuccessfully appealed his conviction of life in prison, always insisting it was Keegan who killed Kristen, a defense that was rejected by the jury. The Essex County District Attorney was opposed to parole for Keegan, and there was a DA's office representative at the hearing with the parole board at the headquarters in Natick on that day. Parole hearings, at least in Massachusetts, are open to the public, by the way. During the four-hour hearing, more than 24 family members and friends showed up for Kristen to make sure her killer stayed behind bars. Keegan made his case for his release from prison during 3 hours of questioning by board members. He minimized his involvement, saying, "I could have saved Mrs. Crowley's life. I could have prevented the entire crime if I had followed my conscience." He insisted he never went into the woods where Dykens had taken her, that he hadn't been leering at Kristen, and the two men weren't out to solicit sex workers. He pleaded guilty the day after Dykens' verdict came down, and he admitted in the hearing that had the jury acquitted Dykens, he probably would have taken his chances at trial. Keegan blamed his dysfunctional life for his behavior and spoke of his accomplishments in prison, how he had earned a bachelor's degree from Boston University through a prisoner education program, how he became a minister. He found Jesus, imagine that. It really is Jesus' favorite place to hide. He became a prison reform activist. He married a woman he met on, wait for it, hotprisonpenpals.com. Yes, it is a real thing, and it's terrifying. Poorly designed, like 1998. That last bit was supposed to be a real feather in his cap, and he was a good family man. But he did have to admit that he was having a relationship with another woman he also met on hotprisonpenpals.com. The board denied his request and would not hear his case again for at least 5 years, much to the relief of Kristen's family, who are burdened with the thought of him being released. They would not have to face it until at least 2016. The Govan Crowley families would be spared. In the early morning hours of August 28, 2013, almost 2 years after his parole request, John Keegan was found unresponsive in his cell at MCI Norfolk. He was transported to Norwood Hospital, where he was pronounced dead at approximately 5:05 a.m. David Traub, the spokesman for the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office, said Keegan was found next to his bunk. An autopsy showed no evidence of foul play, and the medical examiner withheld ruling until a toxicology report was completed. His cause of death is unknown. I did contact the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office for a cause of death. I have yet to hear back. But when I know, you will know. Timothy Dykens is serving a life sentence. He will never get out. In June of 2012, the city of Peabody dedicated a section of the city bike path at the Independence Greenway in Kristen's name. Something to remember her by. I'm so sorry that happened to you. Kristen was killed 25 years ago, but not much has changed. Women remain at risk for being women. And no, not all men. So don't write to me to say men can't go out at night without being accused of a crime. But I will tell you this. Every gross comment, uncomfortable stare, footsteps too close behind me, a car following me for too long, someone coming to my home and defacing my property, it's all been a man. So let's do better. Just this month, Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman, disappeared in South London while walking home from a friend's house. A week later, Wayne Cousins, a Metropolitan Police officer, was arrested. First, on suspicion of Sarah's kidnapping, and later, suspicion of her murder. Her remains were discovered the next day in a wooded area in Ashford, Kent. Cousins is charged with her kidnapping and her murder. He is a police officer. We must do better. Thank you for listening. Crimeofthetruestkind.com is where you can find everything about the show, show notes, the merch store. Get a fancy-ass coffee mug. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, hey, even if you don't, subscribe, rate, and review. Thank you to those of you who have left fresh new reviews. I will read them on the next show. Thank you to those of you who have contributed to Buy Me a Coffee. Patreon is in the works. I know I've said that for the last couple of episodes, but you can't rush these things. Crime of the Truest Kind on Facebook and Instagram, at Truest Kind on Twitter and TikTok. And Buy Me a Coffee. I might actually make it through this show without a dog barking or snorting. And for the record, I love dudes, just not the ones who beat and rape women. Goes without saying, doesn't it? All right, until next time, lock your goddamn doors. And make sure no one's following you home.